I have been something of a schlemiel this week. And that is why I am pampering myself a little this morning. Purim, my dear friends, is a gay holiday. A Yom Mishter V'Simcha, a day of feasting and joy. It's a day of parties and masquerades and plays and buffoonery. A day for exchanging gifts, giving gifts to the poor. And one is even permitted to get a little shikar on Purim. One holiday when one is a little urged to get a little shikar. But the holiday was never lightly regarded. A whole book is devoted to it in the Bible, the book of Esther. A whole tractate is devoted to it in the Talmud. All the festivals, say the rabbis, will in the future be abolished, not Purim. All the books of the prophets and the writings, the Nevi'im and Ksuvim, will in the future, in the days of the Messiah, be abolished, not the book of Esther. Everyone must listen to the reading of the Megillah, young and old, the men and women. The priest in the temple must interrupt his service to listen to the reading of the Megillah. The scholar must interrupt his studies. Now, why is all this profound seriousness attached to a holiday whose mode of celebration is one of hilarity and jubilation? I read the Megillah last Wednesday evening, Purim evening, even as I have done all through these years. And I was again impressed with the strange, unreal character of the story. It reads like an Oriental tale out of A Thousand and One Night. Like one of those stories which begin, once upon a time there was a... And then off you fly on a magic carpet into a fabulous realm of make-believe where the most unbelievable things happen in a most unaccountable way. As you read the Megillah, before you lies ancient Persia, peopled with satraps and vaziers and princes and nobles, ruled over by a most powerful potentate who reigns over 127 provinces and sits high on his throne in Susa, the capital. And fabulous banquets are held in the royal palace, some of them lasting 180 days, where the king displays the riches of his royal glory and the splendor and the pomp of his majesty to his guests. Drinks are served in golden goblets, each of a distinctive design, and the royal wine flows lavishly according to the bounty of the king. And to one of these banquets, the queen is summoned by the king when his heart was merry with wine, to show the people and the princes her beauty. And the queen refuses to come. And forthwith he is deposed. And forthwith the king orders his officers and all his provinces to gather all the beautiful young maidens to his harem in Susa. And from among them the king selects his new queen, a maiden by the name of Esther, who does not at first make known that she is Jewish. Her uncle's name is Mordecai, and he promptly discovers a plot to assassinate the king. And his meritorious act is recorded in the royal chronicles. And then after these things, a prince by the name of Haman is elevated by the king to the highest rank in the empire. And everyone bows down to him, except Mordecai. And Haman is filled with fury, but he disdains to lay hands on Mordecai. But learning that Mordecai was a Jew, Haman decided to destroy all the Jews throughout the empire. And he quickly persuades the king. It is not for the king's profit to tolerate the Jews. The king then promptly takes his signet ring from his hand and gives it to Haman. And an edict is promptly issued to destroy, to slay, and to annihilate all Jews, young and old, women and children, in one day, on the 13th of Adar. And by this time, as you read the Megillah, you are prompted to cry out, this isn't history. This couldn't have happened. This is a storyteller's invention or exaggeration. How could the ruler of the greatest empire of ancient times, Persia, which is remarkable for its administrative organization, its arts, and its skills, how could he have possibly consented to the total annihilation of an important segment of the population of his empire, of peaceful subjects, who had shown no hostility to his rule, and were guilty of no crime against the state? Impossible. You get the same reaction when you read in the book of Exodus that a certain Pharaoh of Egypt once issued a decree that every son born to a Hebrew shall be cast into the Nile. Fanciful. Bizarre, you say. How could the great empire of ancient Egypt, the cradle of civilization, stoop to such barbarism? It is one of those once upon a time stories. And then you are suddenly struck as if by a bolt. Why, no. This isn't fantastic at all. It's real. It happened. It happened not so long ago. It happened in my own lifetime. Once upon a time, there was a Hitler, and children were thrown into crematoria, hundreds of thousands of them. Once upon a time, there was an Eichmann, and an Auschwitz, and a Majdanek, and a Buchenwald, and a Belsen. This is why we are so firmly urged to read the Megillah, to remember a basic law of our history. Things that can never happen do happen. We must never rule out the impossible. We must never rest easy on pet logical calculations. It was the great Maimonides who said, long after the memory of the last persecution is forgotten, the lesson of Purim should be remembered. An Amalek is always a possibility. We have a special Sabbath known as Shabbat Zachor, when we are asked to remember what Amalek once did to the children of Israel when they were fleeing from Egypt. Amalek attacked them on the way when they were faint and weary. And especially did he attack those who lagged behind and killed them. Why did Amalek do it? What had Israel done to Amalek? Nothing. What did the Israelites do to the Egyptians? Joseph had saved the people of Egypt from famine. But a new Pharaoh arose who did not remember Joseph, who said to himself, "Behold, the people of Israel are too many and too mighty for us." And so, Hayoro Tashlichu, cast them into the Nile, the newborn. And he devised a policy of extermination. And what had the Jews of Persia done? And most of the Jews of the 4th century before the Common Era, please remember, lived in the Empire of Persia, including the Jews of Palestine and Egypt and Babylonia, not merely of Iran. While they were loyal subjects, many of them occupied high positions. Ezra, Nehemiah, but one man in a seat of power, one man of inordinate pride and jealousy, one man who had become mad by a consuming hate against one Jew, evolved a plan to destroy all the Jews. There is always an Amalek. The motives differ. The men and the occasions differ. But there is always an Amalek. At times he is frustrated. At times he succeeds. It may be a king or an emperor or a top sergeant. It may be a religious zealot leading a crusade or a fanatical leader of a national uprising. It may be a statesman whose policies failed and who is seeking a scapegoat. It may be a man driven by envy or lust of power or hate. And in every society, there is always an inescapable number of ready followers, of men who enjoy sadistic work. Perverts, killers, psychotics, adventurers. In peaceful times pass them by. But they sprout like dragon teeth when a country is disturbed and its people are unhappy. And Amalek is always there, always a possibility. This is what Purim wishes to bring so forcibly to our attention. This is the overtone beneath all and above all the ringing of the bells, the jubilation, and the masks, and the Mardi Gras spirit. I finished reading this last week, another Megillah. A Megillah of blood and tears and of fire and death. The Last of the Just by Andrei Schwarzbart. It's a scroll of Jewish martyrdom since the Middle Ages, culminating in the Nazi Holocaust. It is written brilliantly, surrealistically, with a pathos which frequently moves you to tears, with a realism that fills your heart with terror, and with a compassion that humbles and purges your soul. The Last of the Just. It is constructed around an ancient legend of our people, the legend of the 36 righteous, the Lamedvav Tzaddikim. The unknown men whose piety sustains the world. The origin of the legend may be traced back to the famous Babylonian Rabbi Abaya of the 3rd and 4th century, who said, "The world contains no less than 36 righteous men in each generation who are vouchsafed the sight of the Shekhinah, as it is written in the book of Isaiah, Ashrei kol chochei lo, blessed are all they who wait for him." Lo, the Hebrew word lo, the numerical value of it, lamed vav, is 36. There are, of course, other righteous men in each generation, many more. But these 36 see God through a bright speculum, especlaria amira, while all the other righteous see him only dimly. They have a clouded vision of him. Now the author of The Last of the Just exercises the privilege of a novelist and reconstructs the legend in two ways. In his novel, the 36 righteous belong to an hereditary spiritual dynasty, as it were. And the rare grace descends from father to son through the generations. The first of the just was a Rabbi Yontov Levi of York in England. But during the crusading period in 1185, he gathered all the remaining Jews of York into the Tower and exhorted them not to surrender their faith because they were given the choice of life or surrendering their faith. All died as martyrs, Yontov Levi wielding the knife by which he himself perished. That was the first of the 36 righteous. The last is Ernie Levi, who dies in the gas chamber of Auschwitz. The second reconstruction of the legend is even more drastic. According to the author, these 36 righteous take upon themselves all the sins of the world. They suffer willingly, silently, uncomplainingly, and it is through their suffering that the world is somehow saved. For the Lamed Vav, he writes, are the hearts of the world multiplied, and into them, as into one receptacle, pour all our griefs. This is a rather Christological concept, and it is not of the essence of the original tradition at all. In the old tradition, a Lamed Vavnik might suddenly appear in cases of an extreme danger to the people and avert the disaster. The last of the just is this Ernie Levy, who is really the 6 million Jews martyred by the Nazis, and all the martyred Jews who preceded them. The author would have you see, without saying it in so many words, he would have you see the Jewish people who are walking the bitter roads of Europe through the centuries, Crusades, Black Plague, the Expulsion, the Inquisition, the Auto da Fe, the Cossack bloodbaths. He would have you see the Jewish people walking through the centuries and through hate and shame and degradation, coming at last in the person of Ernie Levy to the gas chambers of Auschwitz. He would have you see in the Jewish people the Christ of the ages, suffering in silence for the sins of the world and as yet unable to redeem the world. It's a sad Megillah to read, this last of the just. I was left with the impression that something had somehow been overstated in the book. Too much, in my judgment, is made in the book of the virtue of resignation, of silent submission to evil and violence, of self-immolation. To be helpless in the face of overpowering brute force is one thing. To seek helplessness as a way of salvation is another thing. And the Jewish people never willingly accepted this role of the suffering servant of Yahweh as the guide for their career among the nations of the world. The defenders of the Warsaw Ghetto, in my judgment, were closer to the Jewish tradition of resistance to evil. Unfortunately, there were too few of them. Unfortunately, resistance to the Nazis began too late, not only for Jews, but for the world. Many Jews were beguiled. Why, this couldn't happen here. It couldn't happen in the land of Schiller and Goethe. Surely not this. By their own conceptions of basic human standards of decency, finally trapped them and destroyed them. No, the legendary 36 righteous of our people were never suffering pacifists. They were not chosen to die for the world, but to live for it. And in our tradition, there is never the last of the just. In every generation, there are just men and women who have received an added measure of grace, of leadership, of insight, of courage, of faith. give it to their people. Mordecai was such a man. He may have been one of those legendary righteous men. He was a humble man, Ish Yehudi Hayah, just a Jew, came with the exiles, an unknown man. But in a moment of danger, he would not rest. He sent word to his cousin, the queen, Esther, secured in the palace. Act now. Face danger and even death, but speak up now in behalf of your endangered people. Mordecai is the Jewish ideal of the tzaddik in each generation who comes to the defense and the salvation of his people. Purim is a reminder to hit at evil, to hit at bigotry, whenever, wherever, and as soon as it raises its head. This is the testament of the just of our people throughout the ages. Evil must be destroyed. And never assume that times are so secure and safe that this one evil man or this one evil group is of no consequence. It should be ignored. Remember the story of Purim and of all the Purims throughout the ages. Once upon a time there always is. And because there always is, there must always be in each generation men and women prepared to meet the evil, face the evil man, to act. This is the important message of the festival of Purim. Amen.